There was a tragic story. This story is, it goes beyond tragic. Tragic plus avoidable. The story of this young girl, and we have to call her a girl, hardly a woman, who, upon taking RU486, suffered complications and eventually died. It was in the news a couple of weeks ago. You remember this, Holly Patterson? She took the abortion pill, RU486, and she suffered all of the side effects that those who are in the know women suffer from this. She ended up dead. How do we respond to this? What should the medical community, especially a pro-life medical community, be doing about that? We're going to be talking a little bit about the medical dangers of the abortion pill, RU486, during this first half hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Gene Rudd joins us. He's Associate Director, Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. In the second half hour of the program, Dr. Cameron McKenzie joins us. From 3:30 to 4:30, we'll be talking about the diet of worms. It's not worms, it's worms, but we'll say worms for the sake of argument. It is not a new variation on the Atkins diet. It is, in fact, a theological disputation. The opportunity where Luther, his first opportunity, to recant officially his teachings, wherein he did not recant. We'll be talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie about that from 3:30 to 4:30. Well into the second hour, we'll begin a conversation with Dr. Frank Beckwith. He has co-edited a new book called The New Mormon Challenge. Should we simply dismiss the claims, the truth claims of Mormonism out of hand, or should Christians be keen to take into account Mormon scholarship? They actually do have scholars and apologists working on their truth claims. Which should we do? Simply dismiss them out of hand, or know what it is Mormon scholars are saying? We'll talk about that all the way to the end of Issues, Etc. Dr. Frank Beckwith will join us for that conversation. Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. He joins us to talk about the dangers of the abortion pill, RU486. Dr. Rudd, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. From a doctor's perspective, if you would, review for us this tragic story of Holly Patterson.
Well, young Holly Patterson had an unwanted pregnancy, like so many young women, tragically, in our society today. And that's the first tragedy, is that she got into that situation. But wanting to keep this quiet, only her boyfriend apparently knew, she sought help from a Planned Parenthood clinic there in California, and they provided her the RU486 regimen. Now, the RU486 regimen actually involves two drugs. The real RU486 is a drug called mifepristone, and then it's followed a couple of days later with a drug called misoprostol. And if you ever want to design a complicated drug protocol that has some serious complications to it, you'd probably use those two words to name it, mifepristone and misoprostol. It's a mouthful, but she took the first drug and then 2 days later took the second drug, and then the third day reported to the emergency room complaining of symptoms that, to the under-informed doctor, could not be differentiated between the normal side effects of taking these drugs and serious life-threatening complications. The emergency room sent her home with some pain medication. She was bleeding and cramping. And, of course, you do that when you go through one of these chemical abortions. And they didn't know to tell her that there was something more serious going on. There was a breach in protocol, by the way, in which when she took the second drug, the misoprostol, she apparently took it at home, and the protocol calls for her to be seen at the time the second drug is taken. And that does have some safety benefits to it, in that an experienced doctor may be able to determine something at that point that would indicate things are not going well. But the reason for two drugs, by the way, is the first, the mifepristone, which is the name of RU486, it's an anti-progesterone drug. Progesterone is a very critical hormone for early pregnancy development. And to block that is essentially like turning off food and water for a born baby. It's an essential nutrient of development. And when that's blocked, of course, that baby's going to die. And that's what happens when you take mifepristone. But then you've got a dead baby in the uterus. And you have to then come along and take the second drug, which effectively puts the woman into labor and causes the uterus to contract, and that unwanted pregnancy is then expelled. So the woman goes through several days of bleeding and cramping and passage of tissue, ultimately, in order for a chemical abortion to be effective. But when Holly was going through all that, the emergency room did not recognize that she was in trouble, and she went home and, as a good patient, just followed the recommendations to put up with it. And then 48 to 72 hours later, she was in the throes of a infection, a life-threatening infection, and though she presented to the emergency room on death's door, it was too late for them to save her. And she had not fully expelled the tissue and gotten an infection from that, and tragically died. You know, the response of her father really touched my heart. He, of course, was grieving the loss of his daughter, but he was also concerned about the loss that other women were going to face because of this unsafe drug being on the market.
Did we need the death of Holly Patterson to show us that RU486 is a dangerous drug regime?
Well, Todd, some of us didn't need it. We protested to the FDA before they even approved this drug, and that approval process needs to be known by your listeners, too. We can get back to that. But we protested it before it was even approved. And then after it was approved in the year 2000, in September 2000, we started seeing the concerns, the consequences that we had predicted. And in August of 2002, just a little over a year ago, we filed a citizen's petition with the FDA pointing out all the flaws with the drug, the dangers, the complications that were already taking place, and we asked the FDA to pull the drug off the market for safety reasons. You know, we need to put aside all of our ideologies about abortion for a moment and just look at the safety issues for the women that are taking it. And I think if people would just do that objectively, they would say, we can't have this in our society, a drug that is going to kill women who are trying to have an abortion.
How was the approval of RU486 undertaken by the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, this is quite interesting. I think it's very fair. It's always a subjective assessment, but I think it's very fair to say that the Food and Drug Administration was under intense pressure from certain persons in Congress and from the current White House administration based on political commitments and their commitment to the abortion industry, that this drug was going to get approved. So unprecedented, on an unprecedented decision, the Food and Drug Administration decided to put the approval process into what's called a fast-track approval process that's restricted for life-saving drugs. RU486 is hardly a life-saving drug. But life-saving drugs are drugs that if the approval process is delayed, there's going to be loss of life, such as with cancer patients or AIDS patients, and that's why that process was approved. Now, putting it on fast track may cause you to lose sight of some safety issues. You might not have all the data you want, but because lives are going to be lost if you continue to drag it out, you take some risk by going ahead and approving the drug without all the data necessary. And then you can collect that later on. That's the whole intent of that fast-track approval process. For reasons that were probably political and ideological, RU-46 got put into that hopper.
Well, let's go into those reasons for just a moment. Because even to, regardless of where someone stands on the debate of abortion, it's difficult to make the case that RU-486 was a life-saving drug likened to AIDS drugs or cancer drugs or anything like that. What was behind the fast-tracking of RU-486 through the FDA?
Well, there's a good bit of documentation of communication and pressure brought to bear by, say, Congresswoman Boxer, and also by the White House administration, who pressured, and probably by Vice President Gore, who pressured the FDA to put this as a priority, to get this through while that administration still had influence over it. And I don't think we can find any other reason scientifically, medically, the need in society. There's no other good reason to understand how that fast-track approval process was selected except because of political pressure.
Tell us about a recent brief submitted by your organization and others to the FDA. What does it have to say about RU486?
Well, we're reminding the FDA of what they should have known already, in that they have an obligation to watch over the safety of drugs that are coming into our culture. And we reminded the FDA that they chose a fast-track approval process that was not appropriate for this drug. We reminded them that they breached their own standards of controls to approve effectiveness and safety. Normally, the FDA will require at least 2 double-blinded, randomized, concurrently controlled studies. Now, those are all fancy words a lot of people don't use regularly, but it just means there's certain quality of study that are required before we will accept the data as being reliable. Well, the FDA did not apply those standards to the studies that were looked at with RU46 during its testing period. A lot of the data came out of France, where all the parameters were different. Some of the complications that happened in France were swept under the carpet and weren't realized until later. A lot of the safety controls that were put into those studies, for some inexplicable reason, the FDA took those safety controls out of it when it approved it for use in this country. Let me give you an example. Ultrasound is a very reliable means of dating pregnancy and assuring that the pregnancy is inside the uterus. Well, we know that RU46, it has a terrible track record when it's used later in pregnancy, after 7 weeks. Well, to know how far along a pregnancy is, you need some reliable measurements, and ultrasound is one of those. Well, the FDA said, no, we're not going to require ultrasound to be used when we release it in this country, even though it was used in the research protocols. And even though in the research protocols, ultrasound showed that there were some patients that shouldn't be getting it, and they didn't get it. And it also is very important for ruling out an ectopic pregnancy, a pregnancy, say, that's in the fallopian tube, because giving RU46 in that situation can be and has been life-threatening and life-taking to patients. We now have cases of ectopic pregnancies where women have died who took RU46 because they didn't know they had ectopic. Ultrasound would have given us answers that helps us with pregnancy dating or with knowing whether it's an ectopic pregnancy or not, so that RU46 treatment could have been avoided.
Even if the FDA went through all of the proper protocols, the testing, the recommendations about how this drug regime is to be administered, even if they do that, let's say they pull it, they go back through it and do it the right way, and then they reissue an approval for RU486, does that mean RU486 is safe?
I can't see any way that a reasonable person is going to make that determination. Let me put it in perspective. If you're a woman and you're sitting there and saying, well, I'm going to have an abortion, the law allows me to have an abortion, and I have an option of having a 5 or 10 minute surgical procedure under anesthesia, I don't know what's going on. We have, yes, it has complications to it, but they're known, well-studied now, predictable, and it's a known quantity. Versus having to go through several days of pain and bleeding and passing of tissue and having to go through essentially a surgical a labor that lasts for several days, what option are you going to choose? Just from the social, emotional, psychological impact, that's why studies are showing that only 18% of women that are offered this are choosing it. That to tell us something. And it also is telling that over the majority of clinics, abortion clinics out there, are not offering RU46 to their patients. They may be choosing to do that for economic reasons. They may be choosing to do that for liability reasons because they know there's going to be complications with it.
So why are organizations like Planned Parenthood and other pro-choice organizations sound so in favor of RU486?
Well, they sound in favor of it. They're acting in favor of it. It's because they don't want to give up any turf to their battle to have abortion on demand. And to give up on this that they've invested so much in now would be, in their mind, I think, losing ground. And unfortunately, they're willing to put the lives of women in this country on the at risk in order to satisfy that political agenda. It's just appalling to me. I can't think of any other reason when right now there are other ways to have abortions done that are safer than RU-486. For them to be clinging to this hope and this regimen is just beyond me.
Given the lax oversight, the lax dissemination of information, the lax follow-up that is in evidence from abortion providers, it sounds like a doubly dangerous combination. One, you have a dangerous drug regime. Two, you have people administering and encouraging women to use this who really have not shown any care for these women as patients.
Well, Todd, the fox is watching the hen houses. The FDA, of course, have staffers that are there now that made this decision, and they're going to protect their decision, perhaps blindly, I hope not. But they need accountability. We need to pray about this. I mean, we need to call upon God to move on people's hearts, but we also need to call upon an accountability mechanism in our society from the media, from the public, from our Congress. And we can do that as individuals. We can petition the FDA, just like Christian Medical Association petition. Individuals can. We can call on our congressmen to say, bring this under scrutiny, because we don't want this danger to be inflicted upon our next door neighbor. We want to protect unborn life, sure, but I want to protect the life of those mothers too. That's equally or more important. Their souls hang in the balance, their lives hang in the balance, and we shouldn't be putting them at risk. But also, the company that makes this has an economic reason to try to sweep the data under the carpet. You know, the reporting of complications is basically a volunteer program in our country. And the abortion clinics that are doing this and the company that is making this, you'll have to rely on them to tell us that these things aren't going right. Now, they've reported hundreds of cases that aren't going right, but I suspect that's only the tip of the iceberg. Now, they're saying, oh, that's an acceptable level, but we really don't know what level it is, because I don't think we can trust that system to tell us when things don't happen well.
Another thing is the age issue. It's certainly not the only issue, but it's one that deeply concerns me. Holly Patterson was 19 years old, so one might say she had reached majority, although 19 is still a girl. But this could at least conceivably be available to a teenage girl whose boyfriend brings her into an abortion clinic without parents' knowledge, in a system where no one could give that child a prescription drug without the parents' consent. Here is something that is dangerous, prescribed by a doctor. In some states, it's illegal to tell the parents.
Isn't that just utterly amazing that, you know, you might have to get a note from the parents before the child can take an aspirin at school, but she can go and get a dangerous drug given to her, go home, be in her bedroom, bleeding and cramping, and not being able to differentiate between whether she's got a life-threatening situation or just, and the parents might just think she's got menstrual cramps, and they're totally in the dark about what's going on, and yet they're supposed to have some oversight and accountability, responsibility, and protection for her lives. And what we're as a society doing is saying we're gonna take away that responsibility, that protective shelter from these young women in their homes. Even this gal was at home living with her parents, and she was in the process of dying, and her parents didn't recognize it. She didn't recognize it. It's just a sad situation. When the FDA rules also require that there be specific drug testing for the age group in which the drugs are going to be used. And we know this drug's used in teenagers, but yet none of the studies looked at it in teenagers, and the FDA guidelines said that's a must. The juveniles, 18 or younger. And you have to have juvenile testing before a drug can get a pediatric or juvenile indication. And it was not done with this. And the FDA, on what basis did they make that decision? No basis. They had no data, no support for approving it for use in juveniles, but they did anyway. Where did that come from?
Finally, Dr. Rudd, how does the average person make the case against the abortion pill, RU486, with their neighbors, their coworkers, their family members?
I think you make the case because so many people think that if we're pro-life, that we just automatically are going to be against anything that like this. But I think we have to make the case that we're just as concerned about these mothers, these mothers who have unwanted pregnancies. And the law of the land right now allows them to go get an abortion. The way I would go about changing the law of the land is not trying to attack a pill that accomplishes the abortion. My concern is solely for the health and safety of these mothers whose lives are being put in danger. I think we just need to communicate that if we all express appropriate concern about the lives of our neighbors, we're not going to allow them to be taking drugs like this.
Dr. Gene Rudd, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. We've been talking about the medical dangers of the abortion pill RU486. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. We'll be talking to him about the prelude to the diet at Worms and the diet at Worms. If you'd like to visit the website for the Christian Medical Association and read their brief sent to the FDA along with other organizations calling for the pulling of RU486 from the shelf, you can go to their website. It's cmdahome.org, cmdahome.org. I think this situation puts on the table an issue that is often glossed over in the whole pro-choice, pro-life debate. And that is, are we talking about medicine? We're certainly talking about a drug here, aren't we? Or surgical abortion. Is it a medical procedure? It certainly uses medical instruments. It's undertaken by people with medical degrees. It has nurses in attendance. It looks like medicine, but it isn't. RU486, it comes in a bottle, you get a prescription, the doctor says you can have it, that sounds like medicine. It isn't. Medicine cures or alleviates symptoms or treats long-term symptoms or alleviates pain. Those are the four things that medicine, be it a surgical procedure or a regime of drugs, do: cure, treat symptoms, treat long-term symptoms, or alleviates pain. Abortion, whether it's done on a table or in a pill bottle, does none of those things. It cures nothing. It relieves no pain. It treats no symptoms. It simply kills. And in the case of RU486, and as we also know, surgical abortion harms the woman as well. It can't be called medicine under any definition. We'll be right back to talk about the diet at Worms.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Faith alone, that was Martin Luther's cry, wasn't it? Yes, but is that all Luther had to say? Was there more to the Reformation than this? And why was it necessary for Luther to assert that we are saved by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone? Our new Issues Etc. book of the month for October is called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. You can order Lift High This Cross online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information about the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Years ago, I was teaching religion class to the eighth graders at our parochial school. one day I had enough of their picking on each other, their cliquishness, their hurtful behavior. So I unloaded the standard grown-up lecture that they had probably heard a million times. "Pastor, you've got it wrong," interrupted a courageous girl. "What? How's that?" I asked. "The reason we act that way is we are afraid we're not going to fit in." Why does that office worker hoard information that would help the rest of you do your job? Why does the up-and-coming professional hide the fact that he's drowning in debt? Why does the fearful woman present herself as having it all together? Is there any way that some of your own behavior grows out of a fear that in some way you're not going to fit in? Because we compartmentalize our hectic lives, security in one area of life does not afford security in another. What we need is a security that embraces every aspect of daily life, a centered sense that it is well with my soul, whatever might try to scare us. Jesus says, "Come unto me," Matthew 11:28.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a calendar that helps people in Italy understand more about Jesus Christ. The mission agency Gospel Missionary Union produces a yearly calendar that gets distributed throughout Italy. The project got started in 1972, and this year about 140,000 copies will be handed out in homes and offices. The calendar also reaches other European countries. Each calendar has scripture text with daily tear-off sheets. It's a simple but practical tool that's used for discipleship and church planning. The Calendar Project for Italy is a supplement to the use of Christian books for both evangelism and discipleship. There are 60 million people in Italy, with large numbers of families who have experimented in the metaphysical and others who are humanistic in their outlook. Pray for Christ to be glorified in Italy. Get prayer information for countries around the world and updates on missions by visiting the website gmu.org. That's gmu.org.
When Pastor John Lukomsky was little Johnny Lukomsky, he watched Saturday morning cartoons. But now that he's a mature adult, he plays on the radio. Hi, this is Paul Clayton. You've got to hear Wrestling with the Basics with Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky. It's kind of a fun approach to a Bible study. We guarantee you will learn something and take something with you from Wrestling with the Basics, Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. The next hour of the program, we're going to spend in our occasional series centering around the chapters and the chapter headings of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. This book walks through the theology of the Reformation by walking through the writings of Luther and the other reformers and the major points of decision, one might say, the major points of controversy that occurred during the Reformation. One of those, one of the first, is the Diet at Worms. We'll get an explanation of what this event was and what led up to it. This is not just some back corner of Western history. This isn't just some Reformation thing we're talking about. This was a major event. Some have called it the continental divide of modern world history. We'll find out why as we talk with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, Todd, nice to be here. Nice to talk to you again.
First of all, explain the oddity of the term that has come. It sounds so funny. I remember as a kid in grade school being taught about the Diet of Worms, and of course the obvious image pops into one's mind. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Worms or Worms is simply a place. It's a city in Germany, and Diet is the name that we give to these assemblies that occurred periodically in the history of the Holy Roman Empire. So it's a the Diet is a political gathering of representatives of the empire, and they took place in different cities, but this particular one in winter and spring of 1521 took place in the city of Worms, if you will, or Worms.
I went to see, with my daughter's grade school class, the Luther film for the third time this morning.
Oh, well, okay, good.
The kids were going, and so Dad decided to go along as well.
Sure.
And there is a telling scene, very beautifully edited in this film, during a boar hunt.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope is out on his papal grounds hunting a wild boar.
Right.
And while this boar is fleeing the Pope and his riders and the dogs, there is a narration going on in the back, which is a quotation from a document issued by the Pope against Luther at this time.
Right.
Exsurge Domine, arise, right. O Lord. Tell us about what the Pope was saying here.
Yeah, well, actually, let me just mention that although the movie has a lot of fictionalized stuff in it, that actually is historically correct. That when this particular bull or papal statement, Exsurge Domine, was issued, signed, I should say, in the summer of 1520, it was signed by the Pope while he was on a wild boar hunt. Maybe he was resting at the time. I'm not sure he was still throwing his spear, but nonetheless, that is historically accurate. And what this was the official papal condemnation of Luther and of Luther's doctrines, at least as the Pope and his advisors had summarized those doctrines in 41 short statements or sentences. And it then became the basis for the excommunication of Luther, which was official in January of 1521. So it's the official Catholic condemnation of Martin Luther that led directly to his excommunication.
And we should point out, in fairness, that this was the Pope and the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church also trying to extend to Luther an opportunity to back out.
Right. It said if you repent and you take everything back, you know, you won't be excommunicated. But it was far along in the process. This was not kind of a negotiating tool or an effort to kind of prove to Luther from the scriptures or even church tradition that was wrong. It was the condemnation of Luther's doctrines, at least up to that point.
So bring us up to speed with what key events led up to this hearing at Worms.
Yeah, okay. Well, this official condemnation in the summer of 1520 had to be published in Germany, or the German states, I should say, in order for it to be legally binding on Luther, and that was turned over to a couple of papal representatives, one of them whose features rather prominently in this new movie version, and that was Jerome Aleander. And the other is somebody whom, if people remember the old Luther version from 1954, that movie that's John Eck. But anyway, those two men were responsible for publishing, and that meant they had to, in a very official, public, and legal way, post notices of this bull condemning Luther and his doctrines. Well, that work was undertaken and was accomplished in the fall of 1520. Wittenberg received its official notification of this bull on October 10th of 1520. And by the rules of the Pope in this particular condemnation, Luther got 2 months in order to reconsider, after which then the threats and so forth of the papal bull against Luther and his followers and writings would become official. And that meant then that Luther would be, as I say, on the road to immediate excommunication, his books to be burned, his followers likewise to be put under papal processes for excommunication. So that's going to take us into December. And at that point, when the papal processes are over, then it's up to the rulers of Christendom to enforce that position regarding the books and Luther and his followers in their various states and territories. And that brings us then to the emperor, Charles V, and his responsibility as a Christian emperor to follow through on what the Pope had decided regarding Luther as a heretic.
Bring us up to speed a little bit on the relationship at this time in European history between emperor and pope, and the melding of princes with bishops. Sometimes the princes are bishops, sometimes they're not. Give us a thumbnail sketch of politics and the intermingling of church and state in Europe at this time.
Yeah, right. I mean, the ideal of medieval and early modern Europe was far different from what it is today. And our ideal is separating church and state. You know, our Supreme Court is going to consider whether you can even say under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. We're so concerned about separating church and state. It was the exact opposite, you know, 500 years, 600 years ago. There, church and state were considered to be in the closest sort of relationship, and that it was the duty of government to support the church, to enforce the values of the church, to make sure that the teachings of the church were what would be heard in society, in the books, in the publications. Rulers were thought of as having their position on account of God's will and God's ordinance, and that meant they had a responsibility to follow through and make sure that their society was as Christian as possible, teaching was pure, doctrine was correct, morals were correct. Closest possible cooperation between church and state. And in fact, in some places, as you made mention, church officials actually were temporal rulers. In a place like Cologne or Mainz, for example, the ruler was a prince of the church. The Archbishop of Mainz was also the temporal ruler of the city of Mainz and the surrounding territories.
So when the Pope says Luther has run afoul of Rome, and here are the charges against him. Luther burns the papal edict, along with canon law and a bunch of other papal documents, thumbing his nose at the Pope's authority. Then it falls to the emperor to, in a sense, be the enforcer of this excommunication.
Yes, the government officials at the time were supposed to carry out the will of the church in these matters because, at least in theory, they were all committed to that church and making that church kind of the official religion in their territories.
Charles V, the emperor at the time, had only recently ascended to that position. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, sure. Well, Charles V was just about 20 years old in 1520. And it was the heir of a long line of important rulers in medieval Europe on both sides of his family, so that through his mother, he was the heir of what today we think of as Spain, but the entire Spanish Empire. Which was growing in the 16th century overseas, you know, Central and South America, also the Philippines, and in the Mediterranean, Spain, or what it really wasn't Spain, it was a couple of parts of Spain, but they were being merged. And so Philip is ruler of that through his mother. And then through his father, he was the Duke of Burgundy. And that meant the ruler of the Netherlands, which was one of the more prosperous areas of Europe at that time. Also, through his father's family, he inherited titles to particular territories within the Holy Roman Empire, the Austrian territories, the Tyrol, Austria, territories in the Alps, and that southern part of German-speaking lands. And then, when he was elected emperor in the summer of 1520, then he becomes, he adds this to his array of titles, and so becomes the head of this large conglomeration of states in the central part of Europe, roughly coinciding with what we think of as Germany today, but not precisely the same. Bohemia, or the Czech, today's Czech Republic, was a part of the empire, and of course that's not a part of Germany today. But so he was probably, at least on paper, the most powerful ruler of his time.
All right. Now let's lay that aside for a moment, because this actual hearing will be at least officially before Charles V. It's not
right.
A church hearing. It is actually a civil hearing.
Right.
The Diet at Worms.
Right.
How? Explain to me how this works.
I mean,
the Pope had said, mm-hmm. recant or you be excommunicated.
Right.
Luther said, fooey on you. The Pope actually, in January of 1521, issued the bull that excommunicated Luther.
Right.
And then he gets a hearing?
Yeah, it was irregular. And that is one of the things that shows us, even apart from Martin Luther, that the Middle Ages are coming to an end. In theory, what should have happened is that the church condemns Luther, and then all of the Christian rulers, including the emperor, would simply have enforced the decision of the Pope against Luther. Instead of that, however, Charles V did agree with the important members of the Diet, including and especially Luther's own prince, a territorial ruler by the name of Frederick, usually called Frederick the Wise, a very important prince of the empire. Well, Charles agrees with Frederick that they should not just automatically proceed against Luther, but that instead he should be provided a hearing, a forum, if you will, before the representatives of the German nation in connection with this Diet at Worms. Now, it doesn't seem that Charles V, that this was Charles's own idea. It's pretty clear that he had no intention of protecting Luther. He was a good Catholic, and though he always didn't agree with the Pope, he was very proud of the fact that he and his ancestors had always been strong supporters of the Catholic Church. But if he was going to be a successful ruler in the German areas of his empire, or anywhere else for that matter, he would have to work closely with individuals who actually exercised power in local areas, local arenas. You know, this is a pre-modern state. If he wants to get something done somewhere, he can't send an army. He can't even make a telephone call. He has to have somebody there whom he can trust and who he can work with. So if he wants to exercise real authority within the empire, he needs to have the cooperation of people like Frederick the Wise, the territorial ruler of Saxony, where Luther was, where Wittenberg was, and so forth. So when Frederick kind of pushes the issue with him that they shouldn't just automatically proceed against Luther without Luther getting a hearing on German soil in front of representatives of the German nation and German church, Charles is willing to make that concession. This is over the protests of the papal representative there, who thought that they should just act against Luther right away, but nonetheless, Charles is willing to do that for Frederick.
We're talking about the prelude to the Diet at Worms, and we'll get to the Diet at Worms on the other side of the break. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So Frederick the Wise is Luther's prince. He is a powerful man in the empire, one of those who elects the emperor.
Right.
And he is simply trying to hold the emperor to or protect his own sovereignty in a sense by saying, look, the German states are German states in and of themselves. If you're going to condemn a German subject, you need to do it on German soil.
That's right. I mean, one of the things, one of the themes that Luther speaks to prior to the Diet of Worms is a kind of German nationalism. I mean, that might be a little too strong, but if you look at some of these things he wrote, including even the 95 Theses, Luther kind of harps on the fact that there is this Italian church that is exploiting the Germans, taking money out of Germany down to build churches and who knows what else in Italy. And he feeds then on a great deal of resentment that there was within the empire against the Pope and the Italians and so forth, so that even if people didn't understand Luther's message about justification by faith, there was a lot in what he was writing and saying that would make sense to people like Frederick or others who were resentful of what they felt was this exploitation.
And from the emperor's side, he essentially is faced with a dilemma where he's got the Pope breathing down his neck about this excommunicated monk, Luther, mm-hmm. do away with this guy, let's get rid of him. But on the other side, if the emperor's going to raise an army or raise money, he needs these German princes, and he needs their cooperation.
Exactly correct. He has an agenda. Oftentimes, his agenda for his entire reign is described as three things. One is to maintain his hegemony, his leadership in Europe, over against particularly France, which was kind of the only rival, the King of France, the only rival to the emperor that there was, significant one. Second thing that he's concerned about is Eastern Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean with the Turks. The Turks are a powerful force out there, had been in the 15th and 16th century, would be during Charles's reign. So he's concerned about that. And then finally, he's concerned about religious unity in his empire. But sometimes he needs to make concessions to people like Frederick within the empire in order to advance his imperial interests elsewhere.
I am struck at this point, Dr. McKenzie, at the nexus, the coincidence of events that bring about this simple event, the Diet at Worms,
mm-hmm.
that had it had been a different emperor of a different nationality and lineage, had it been a less powerful prince under which Luther was protected,
none of
this would have occurred.
Absolutely. And you could really see the hand of providence in the life and career of Luther. The Diet of Worms is one particularly famous incident that shows that, but throughout Luther's life. I mean, there's so many things happening that Luther has absolutely no control over, and yet they work to make possible his work of preaching and teaching the gospel.
So how did this hearing before the emperor, how did it get called? Bring us up to the point where the hearing begins.
Yeah. Well, Charles is elected emperor when he is down in Spain. Remember, he's king of Spain. So he has to come to his empire, and that doesn't happen until the fall of 1520. He makes his way, first of all, to Antwerp and then to the old medieval city of Aachen, where emperors were crowned. And then from there, he is going to go into the empire and have or hold his first diet. And the diet, remember, it's kind of an invitation-only affair, but emperors routinely invited to a diet for consideration of imperial matters, representatives of all the important cities and states into which the empire was divided. So he's planning to do that, and the Luther problem is really not on his agenda. What he wants to do is to talk with them about how the empire is going to be governed, problems perhaps with the Turkish menace, things that have to do with imperial problems. But in connection with that, it's just at that time that he's going to hold this diet that the Pope gets around to condemning Luther, and then therefore the Luther affair gets put onto the new emperor's agenda. And then Frederick, because he's such an important person within the empire, has an opportunity to see to it that Luther will be invited to the Diet of Worms as well.
He is being invited to do what?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, the actual invitation really talks only about there being an inquiry into Luther's teachings and doctrines. You could read it that Luther is going to get a hearing and an opportunity to talk and present and to define what it is he's teaching about it. But if you're on the other side, you could read it as saying, well, Luther is going to get one opportunity, and that is to recant. So I think from the standpoint of Luther, he thinks it's going to be an opportunity to present the truth. From the standpoint of his opponents, they think it's going to be an opportunity for Luther to recant or else simply to be condemned.
We're talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie, getting up to the point of the diet at Worms. When we come back, we'll talk about this hearing itself. Folks, if you want to read more about this and the other pivotal events and writings of the Lutheran Reformation, our new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is right up your alley. Very readable, very complete. Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. It walks through the major events of the Lutheran Reformation up to the issuing of the Augsburg Confession, and it does it through the writings of Luther and the other reformers. You can order this book, Lift High This Cross, by calling Concordia Publishing House in the next hour or weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. In fact, during this break, give them a call, 1-800-325-3040. Mention Issues Etc. and ask for our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. You can also go online to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the book. The book costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. You can also visit one of the Concordia Publishing House bookstores, either at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. We'll be talking about the hearing at Worms. How did it go? Was it a simple affair? Was it simply Luther standing up and saying, "Here I stand, I can do no other"? We'll find out when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.